Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by the Dudley Boys of What Culture, Michael Hamflett and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite Beach Break. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review AEW Dynamite, but also AEW Rampage, Raw, SmackDown, NXT 2.0, pay-per-views, premium bloody live events. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week complete with a bloody quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, though, joined by the Dudley Boys to review AEW Dynamite Beach Break, and a show that was all over the shop, Sidge.
I think I wanted to like the main event so much more because I was on such a high from the first, like, 45 minutes, but it never reached that crescendo again. Crawled very, very slowly and methodically towards an 8 for me, but I'm going to revise that down to 7.5. One of the best things I've ever seen on Dynamite, though, so you can't really begrudge it.
That opener was just bonkers, wasn't it?
I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. I can't wait to talk about why, and for that reason, we should go to Michael Hamflett, Debbie Downer first. Because,
it's weird, right, because there's an exceptional segment on this Dynamite, like absolutely exceptional, elite tier, fittingly. Pro wrestling, the exact reason you tune into it. And yet, we've kind of talked about how it is to be spoiled now by all the wrestling that have an AEW, especially to have, like, the standards that it set. I thought this was a really middling. I wasn't as moved by the opener, and I think that maybe set a tone for a show that I was willing to get better that didn't, save for the exceptional segment. Do you know what it was? None of this was like it's egregiously bad. The Dynamite we were all particularly critical of a few weeks ago, and it didn't even make some of the mistakes that I felt like a lot of Dynamites recently have been making. I just thought it was pretty boring. Like, the crowd were hot, and I don't think they were being the opener is obviously going to be like the source of debate here, I guess. Like, I thought it was still great. I wasn't necessarily like head over heels with it as like a lot of people seem to have been, but throughout the duration of the show, I don't know. Everything between these like really meaty bits that clearly meant loads, it just felt like they were dogging it a bit. There was nothing that I thought was like even approaching good beyond these two specific checkpoints. The main event seems to be drawing a bit of debate as well. Like, often you're very kind to shows by introducing them as divisive. I think this was the definition of divisive, and not just because like me and Sid were going to disagree over a couple of things, because it just did feel like the sort of show where a lot of people will probably leave immensely happy with the AEW. They saw this is the vision of the AEW they want. I was like really underwhelmed by like large portions of a 2-hour show.
I don't know what rating I'd give this show, because I went in off the back of the podcast just a little bit worried, like you said, about this show of like, if things go wrong, this is going to go really off the rails. So I don't know. I wake up this morning, I put it on and I go, here we go then. And then that opener happens and I was like, well, that was phenomenal. And then it almost affected my viewing of other parts of this show where I was like, it's not the opener though, is it? And then like the main event, I really enjoyed. And I said yesterday, and we'll get into it when we get there, they're going to have to do a lot to sell me on not even buying an Orange Cassidy win, wanting an Orange Cassidy win. I know he's the babyface and blah, blah, blah. But I was sat here yesterday, arms folded, going, you should not be beating your number one contender ahead of him challenging for the world title in 5 weeks or whatever it is. And then at the end of the show, I'll tell you this right now, I'll admit this. So it's running a little bit late this morning. So I watched everything up to the break in the main event, dropped Anne-Louise off at work, drove here, and was like, oh, I won't come in and walk into the office because I might get it spoiled or I might, you know, put people off. So I watched it in my car. And I genuinely, I think someone saw me because the moment before the big spot.
Was your barber going, baby! Baby! Everyone's all elite! Everyone's all elite! Everyone is all elite!
And a cheer went up in the room.
There was a bit where I was actively shouting in my car, go on then, right? Which I'll explain when we get to it. So I might have to go through this review with you guys and your analytical knowledge of all of this.
Prowess.
To work out how on earth I actually feel about it. In fact, let's just dive straight into it. Let's start with the ladder match, as you said, Sitch. TNT Championship on the line. Cody Rhodes versus Sammy Guevara. Very amicable to start off with. We started, by the way. I like this as a touch. They did, I think, like a 10-minute beforehand thing on YouTube. We can see the entrances, because when we watch the show, it's literally Cody and Sammy already stood in the ring. A handshake, very respectful. Cody being a bit of a knobhead early on, just sort of taunting, shoving him off, being like, got the better of you, you know, I've beaten you all these times, basically. No one can really establish an advantage early on, though. Then suddenly, they go to the outside. Guevara hits Cody with a pump kick, sends him into the barricade. They fight into the crowd. Cody's high-fiving people, which allows Guevara to recover. He hits a cutter on the floor. He grabs a ladder. He twats Cody with it and then sets it up. Cody gets in there. Cody has set up another ladder, which we'll come into it a lot later on. But Cody gets involved, stops Sammy Guevara climbing, bump heads, double down. Then they both climb the ladder, but it's been moved slightly, so they can't reach the belts. So Cody superplexes Sammy Guevara from the top of the ladder to the floor in a wild spot to take us to commercial. When we come back, Cody's doing that. It's a spot that looks worse than a huge bump or a cutter or a crossroads off the top of the ladder, which is Sammy Guevara getting dropped onto the little slats that, like, make sure the ladder's properly up. It's an inverted ladder, basically. And he puts a figure four on Sammy with a ladder involved in it as well. He beats Guevara down. Then Guevara fires up, makes a comeback, clotheslines. He goes for a springboard and Cody just chucks a ladder at him. Cody climbs, but Guevara climbs his own ladder. And this is the moment where he leaps off the second ladder, grabs Cody and hits him with a cutter. It was just astonishing that, a spot fest to a certain extent, but still, I'm all right with spots like that, as long as they're all right, I suppose. Guevara traps Cody under the ladder, starts climbing it, and then Cody powers out and pushes Guevara, and he falls off the ladder and crashes over the ropes. Then they fight on separate ladders, and Cody grabs Sammy Guevara and crossroads him off them onto the mat. And it looks like Cody's going to climb and grab them both, but Guevara gets up there, cuts him off, and then they're both hanging off that bar that's got both belts on, and they eventually both fall off and fall down to the floor. Then on the outside, Cody's got Guevara's leg in a ladder again, and Fuego del Sol comes out and says, you're taking a bit far, this mate. And Cody goes, right, pal driver for you. that allows Sammy Guevara to recover. He hits a springboard, Fosbury flop, a GTH on the floor. And then he puts Cody on that ladder I mentioned earlier that Cody had set up himself. It's bridged between the apron and the barricade. And then he sets up another ladder, goes up it, senton bomb onto Cody. The ladder does not break, which arguably often with table spots makes it look even better / a lot more painful for me. Guevara goes up top, but Cody's recovered. They're fighting on the top of the ladder in the ring right next to the belts. So they batter each other with forearms. Then Guevara grabs the bar with the belts on, hits Cody with the belts. He falls off. Sammy Guevara grabs the two belts. He is now officially Michael Sidgwick, your TNT champion.
I thought this was phenomenal. I absolutely loved it. What I loved most about it, or what I loved about it a lot, is the sheer contrast between this match and the very first match that ever took place on Dynamite, where it was so evident that Sammy Guevara was a young, flashy heel who was nowhere near as experienced or as good as Cody in the main event spot or in such a featured spot. And Cody Rhodes beat him with a roll-up because he used his wrestling acumen to beat him. the tone of this was so much different. You could see the characters, like, informed by 2 years of booking. Like, the dynamic was completely different, and 2 years of really patient, long-term investment arrived at a completely different feel around these two men. So I kind of loved it before it even started. And what I loved as well is that these two men are really close in real life. They're close friends. You can see that they're on each other's, like, Cody appears on Sammy's vlog. Mm-hmm. Clearly, they've established, like, a relationship. And like, I felt all of it, particularly in the first 5 minutes of the match. Cody was being a dick as per. Sammy Guevara was not taking kindly to it. And in a match with such breathtaking spots, which I thought were arrived at tremendously, which I'll get to imminently, one of my favorite moments of it simply was the force with which Cody just smashed him over the barricade. And then when he did the high fives, he did the cutter. But if you noticed, Cody just shoved him over as if to say, no, you little prick. You're not up to my level. I don't care what belt you think you've got. I beat you for it. Just the way he just shoved him over the barricade, I was just... Every single bit of movement, like nothing felt like they were just doing something to arrive at a spot. There was a feeling behind everything. There was an exploration of their actual relationship across, this is a very pretentious thing to say, the extended universe, which includes a TV show and a vlog. But he still got all of it. You could tell that they were like such an amazing competitive edge to all of this that just felt completely authentic. The great spots were so great because bar one, which was the dive off a very tall ladder onto the one that didn't break, the other three major hitters were arrived at when they were trying to pursue victory by climbing the ladder. So you had the cutter when they were both trying to win. You had that incredible, incredible cutter spot. Again, just to reiterate how great it was, because Cody's timing on that bump was absolute expert, mm-hmm. like absolute like excellence of execution stuff from Cody Rhodes. The
superplex.
The superplex was outstanding. The crossroads was great. I thought Sammy Guevara had broken his goddamn nose. It was tremendous. Even something that felt like a Cody idea. And what I mean by that is a bit of a stupid one. I had to do it on a ladder. At first, I'm thinking, pointless that. And then I thought, oh, he can't actually reverse the pressure because he's trapped inside a ladder. That's actually great. And not only can he not reverse the pressure from this modification of this spot, you're weakening his leg and limiting his ability to climb. I thought this was phenomenal. What I love most about it as well, that Charlton going down the line here to the origins of this very championship. Cody Rhodes wins the matches that people piss and moan that he wins to arrive at matches like this. Mm-hmm. This guy adds prestige. This guy adds a big match aura when he wants to do it to everything that he does. I will close by saying that we were pondering Michael Hamflett's brilliant question last week. Is Cody a clever guy with dumb tendencies, or a dumb guy who can fool you into thinking he's clever? Like, I'll never make my mind up on this because this was so smartly constructed. I'm thinking, how did the same guy work this layout of a match and do that promo last week?
Yeah, it's a fair point.
It's perhaps the intrinsic Cody match, this, because I can't disagree objectively with a single thing Cedric just said there, and yet subjectively I disagree with absolutely all of it. Like, it's so much about the feeling you're supposed to get from a match like this. And I just saw and witnessed everything Sidgwick described and felt none of it. Like, I enjoyed this match at a distance. Like, it's definitely something in the deadening of ladder matches, which is a wrestling problem.
Yeah.
You know.
Andy said the same, didn't he, this morning?
This has been an issue for years, and we're getting, what, like the Face of the Revolution multi-man in 5 weeks' time, and that's going to suffer from this, and so on and so on and so on. Wrestling can't get out of its own way with ladder matches. And this was substantially better than a lot of ladder matches we've been fed over the last few years. It really was, and you could tell. I didn't feel like they were loyal enough to the structure of a ladder match. I did feel like I was watching too many spots that were spot's sake. Cannot fault the execution, particularly of the delayed suplex and the cutter. Those two specifically. Sammy Guevara, the cutter. Sammy Guevara has a habit now, is developing a pretty cool habit of spots that instantly need to go into video packages and credit sequences. The dive onto MJF and this. Are the sort of things that will live way longer in the memory than, well, the majority of his first run with the TNT title, quite honestly. And that matters just as much now. It really does. Like, the currency of wrestling is changing to the point where it is the cutter, let's be honest. Like, the other spots, as great as they were within the body of the match, it is the cutter that's going to stick. It's as important to generate something resembling an Edge Jeff Hardy spear in a match like this, as much as just having a great match. So I can appreciate that on one hand. and then just feel like I was watching a disjointed collection of spots. The other issue I took with this, and I'm glad Sidgwick brought up the point of Cody always winning the matches that needle folk, because the defeats have to matter so much more. I credited Cody yesterday on the preview as maybe standing up in the room and saying, Guevara needs somebody to be that's definitely going to generate boos and generate cheers for him. If we're going to heat this story, this Sammy story back up, he needs me, because they're not going to go with me. I kind of think they did. I thought Cody worked such a virtuoso performance here that for the night, a lot of people forgot what it was they didn't like about Cody Rhodes and kind of got into him all over again, because he's absolutely got this in his locker sometimes. I've been a critic of plenty about Cody, but it's rarely about the work when he shines this bright. You know, he was excellent here, and not at his fault at all, but almost too good for me. I was wowed by Cody far more than I was taking on Sammy Guevara's hero's journey, like I was, for example, when he beat Miro. Really different vibes. Sammy Guevara's up there holding up the two belts, and it's the Hogan Warrior thing. I'm way more interested in on the other guy. I want to look more at Cody's reaction to that loss than I do Sammy Guevara's celebration of the win. And I don't know if that's the fault of the construction of the match, the sheer star power that Cody's got. But if I felt they were aiming for... Put it like this, when Cody Rhodes got on one knee for Darby Allin, I bought that. Like, this has been a story. You couldn't beat me. You've done it. Here's the belt. Young Padawan. None of that here. Like, I didn't get any of that here. And whether or not I just didn't feel that chemistry that Sidgwick described between the two of them as friends, or whether or not Cody's a weird guy that is generating this very unique aura around him that maybe other stars will struggle to get. I wasn't getting pillar vibes from Sammy. I can say this now because they've talked this into existence. You can rank these performances on where they stand as pillars. MJF and Darby Allin at the last pay-per-view being a perfect example of that. I don't know. I'm not an advocate for slow climbing spots, but I didn't get anywhere near enough. I thought this did veer into the indulgence rather than the, how are we going to get the belt? Like, but the exact spots that Sidgwick described were great examples. The cutter was a sublime example of how to do something awesome. Again, why the Jeff Edge comparison is apt, because Jeff's trying to pull them belts down and Edge needs to stop him. That's not just something for the flashbulbs, you know? And the cutter, I think, was the sublime example of how they brought those two things together. There wasn't enough of that in the rest of the match for me.
Fascinating to know your guys' thoughts about this as well, because like you say, I can see both sides of the argument. I'm leaning towards more Sidgwick's take.
I think I'm in the minority. That was like, I like checked the comments after I finished watching Dynamite, and those people, like, it had the vibe of Dave going 5 on it, maybe 4 and 3, but I was nowhere near that. And
I wouldn't go 5 on it, because it's not one of the best matches I've ever seen. I'd certainly go 4.5, maybe 4 and 3.
I'd probably go 4.5. I think that's fair. I really enjoyed this.
I have to say as well, like, I sometimes feel like we shouldn't need to. Our listeners are an educated, classy lot. But none of this criticism is at the expense of, I can see the risks they're taking. I think it's amazing what they do to their bodies. You know, just sometimes you feel like a dick if you don't just say, like, wow, they really gave themselves to this. So, like, I don't want to not mention that. Like, huge respect to the pair of them for some of the stuff. That ladder not breaking, I think, is such a better choice than it breaking.
Yeah.
Like,
Instant swelling on both of them.
Kind of bored of the balsa wood ladder, so I kind of like that for the pain of it more than it just collapsing underneath his body. But, thanks for your work. It just didn't do it for me. I'm glad it did it for loads of others.
Mm. It was followed by it's beach break. Time to go to the beach. Which is covered in snow, because it's bloody Cleveland. There is Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs and a very cold Tony Schiavone. Hobbs wants Dante Martin to run their match back and say, bit of a fluke sort of thing. And Starks calls out Jay Lethal for an FTW championship match on next week's Rampage, I think he said.
February 4th.
Yeah. Tony Schiavone doesn't care because he thinks his hand's frozen to the microphone. that's a rough tape in that, isn't it?
It was, but I just think it was... Like, basically, the two beach break events have been themed around Orange Cassidy, and that's the name of his finisher. And if it's in January, that's when the storyline demands that beach break happen, it's fine. It was just them having a little bit of fun at the expense of the fact that they are doing beach break in Cleveland in January. But there's still a beach.
I love very small creative choices that the wrestlers are allowed to make. So you've got Tony Schiavone's hand sticking to the microphone, while Powerhouse Hobbs has a fur coat over dungarees and nothing else. What a legend. I love little things like that characters are permitted to do to get them over more. So that's their... Like, I'm going to make a weird comparison, but that's, you just know if his tits bouncing on NXT 2.0 that you just wouldn't get on a Raw SmackDown. Fun stuff that you can have a bit of fun with the next day.
In the words of MJF, the best big man in the game, bar none. Love that. Speaking of which, they're in Cleveland, and it's time for local hero Wardlow to come out and murder some poor local competitors, Elijah Dean and Jake Alexander, on this one. He got a great reaction, as you would expect here. And he wrecked these dudes, power bombs them. I think there's about five power bombs in total, including one on top of another. And then he plants them on top of each other and pins both of them. Sean Spears, giddy as he is, wants to twat him with a chair, and Wardlow goes, chill out a little bit. And they celebrate on the ramp, and we think, ooh, could it be tonight? Straightforward squash this
season. Yeah, he looked awesome, and he got a reaction. I'd like to think he would have got somewhere, something like approaching this reaction if it happened to not be in his hometown, because it's been sort of going up and up and up, the reaction, but obviously he was going to get a great one in Cleveland. I could watch Wardlow do this every single week.
Yep.
I thought, if I'm honest, I think the best thing about this was the segment that followed later on, because I really appreciated the false foreshadow. Like, that was a really nice touch. That elevated a Wardlow. I wouldn't say I'm tired of Wardlow squashes, but it elevated something that was just a nice fixture of dynamite into something like narratively more impressive.
I thought this show was going brilliantly well at this point. And then we got the Inner Circle versus Daniel Garcia and 2.0. Nothing against Santana Ortiz, Daniel Garcia, or 2.0 in this match, but this was not for me, in my opinion. I wanted to write down the notes on this match, but all the attention was on Chris Jericho. The story was, of course, Santana Ortiz not happy with him, and all they do is tagging each other every time. You know, Jericho wanted to start the match off, and I think either Santana Ortiz goes, nah, I'll take this, tags him, and steps in, and there was a point where one of Proud and Powerful got knocked off the apron. And there's Jericho, tag me, tag me, tag me. No, bollocks to you. Well, I'll wait till my mate recovers and just slumps himself on the apron and tag him instead. Santana at one point did run wild. Him and Ortiz hit an assisted cutter and a powerbomb lariat. All looked great, all this. But Chris Jericho jumps off the apron. He's potentially walking out of this match because he's so furious with Santana and Ortiz and this disrespect they are showing him. But then he gets involved. 2.0 are trying to hit their finisher. He breaks it up. And then as Matt Lee is getting chucked into the ropes, he hits him with the Judas effect. He staggers back. Santana hits him with the pile driver. The Inner Circle win. They don't split. And the story must continue, Hamflet.
God, I thought this was like exhausting, fake, hack, carny nonsense. Like, I really did.
I really did.
Like, of course, it was a fine match. Oh, well worked, mechanically sound. Like, who gives a toss about that when the whole point is that you're supposed to be invested in this big angle that hangs over the whole thing? Because that's what this was a presentation of. I couldn't have been less interested by the end. Real am-dram performances from everybody involved. Like, we pick on Jericho, right? And rightfully so a lot of the time. I think like this was on Proud and Powerful too. Like they are all in on this fairly rubbish thing, and they were required to do some acting. And I didn't buy it any more than I bought Chris Jericho's over-egging of his part. I want to give Chris Jericho a bit of credit. Doesn't get much. I think he's looking in decent nick. I found him to be, we know the criticisms he gets, and let's just diplomatically say that I feel like he's maybe addressing some of them criticisms, and that's pretty cool. Like, that's a guy that clearly wants to give as much as he can to this, rather than sometimes when it kind of looks like he should be giving more. Like, you kind of, it's amazing. He's 50 and he does this, you know, but that's going to come with certain caveats, and he needs to apply himself to some of them. But as an angle, I just thought this was like, you know, when you're watching WWE and there's wrestlers that will do their best to commit to the bit, but the bit is like really forced and they're not quite talented enough to make it feel anything less than forced. That was this. And what's worse is that 2.0 can lose all the time. And there are very few acts in AEW because of the ranking systems that like can literally, like you can't lose all the time. Otherwise you're always going to be like bottom feeders. 2.0 always can and always remain over and can sell anything and can come out the next week like nothing ever happened. I like to think that Daniel Garcia is eventually going to have a word and be like, guys, I'm analysing every single one of my defeats on Twitter, and all I'm doing is analysing defeats on Twitter. This can't carry on. And like, that's pretty cool. Like, eventually Daniel Garcia is going to rip himself away from these losers and like get on his own path. And that, like, I think that's pretty cool that you can use them to tell this story. If it was anybody else on the opposite end of this trios match, it would have been an embarrassment that they were defeated by these complete losers that can't just figure it out. Had the stench of like, and I don't want to drag them because it's making me realise how much the tag division misses them at the top, but it had the stench of Young Bucks melodrama. AEW can't do this stuff anywhere near as well as they think they can. Nobody should. WWE can't do it, so I don't know why AEW would bother. Like, tiring. I found this, like, tiring, like, Amdram stuff. yesterday, the whole point was, whoa, they're really accelerating this inner circle thing. Like, somehow they can try to accelerate it and drag it out. I'm bored by all of it.
I felt little for this. I'm going to be a little bit kinder and a little bit harsher. Because where Hamlet said it was a fine match mechanically and all the rest of it, like, deeply familiar sets of faces wrestling again after they've already had the... many of the people involved have already had the big wild fight on Rampage, which was way better than this. This being a singles match, couldn't hope to be as exciting as that. So it's just like, oh, it's a bit familiar, but I understand why they're doing this, because they've got a story to tell that involves doing a trios match. You know, it makes sense because these guys are feuding, et cetera, et cetera. If the idea was they want people to think Santana and Ortiz are the next breakout babyface tag team act and Chris Jericho shouldn't be getting in their way anymore, I don't want to say they underperformed in the spot because I don't think it was actively bad, but there are just little moments where Ortiz and Santana do that spot where Ortiz like sends Santana via roll into a double cutter, and it always just looks so labored and a little bit awkward every single time they do it. It didn't look like a team that was firing on all cylinders, which is what they believe themselves to be and just kind of don't need Jericho anymore. I didn't hate the story beat that Chris Jericho either wants to prove that he's still got something to offer Santana and Ortiz's development, or maybe he kind of, his big bruised ego had to get the win for them. There's a bit of subtlety and nuance to what really is in the minds of everyone involved in the storyline. So I didn't hate the beat, but the match I just thought was, ugh. It was good, obviously.
Yeah.
Solid, but you know my feelings on the word solid.
There are times when AEW is tarred with the can they coexist brush when they're actually attempting to tell a story. It's veered way too much to can they coexist beyond anything else.
A couple of things to set up title matches came next. One I loved, one not so much. It was a video package with Lance Archer and Jake Roberts, and they're talking about the world champion Hangman Page, and they announced that in 2 weeks he's going to have not just a match for the world title, but a Texas death match. And he's basically saying, I'm going to kill him. And my favourite part of this is the one I liked, by the way, was Hangman Page finding out mid-promo, presumably, is going to be a Texas death match. And him saying, what? But then saying he's going to bring hell with him and firing up and responding to the challenge.
Yeah, I like this. I understand a very valid critique that they are absolutely overdoing gimmick matches. I understand that, but at the same time, looking at Archer's performance against Kazarian, like, it needs a shortcut to feel big, ultimately. And they've
and
arrived...
And he's worldwide. He's won titles before in AEW in a Texas death match.
Yes. So, yes, like, great point. It's another little wrinkle that's nice. Also, I hate last man standing matches. They're using Texas death as their version of it because that preceded it. But it was like a sprint between him and Moxley, so I'm expecting them to get it right again. Look, it needs a shortcut, and they've got one. It doesn't... It's not very good that they are doing it after a match on which stipulation excess kind of swamped the show in itself, but, you know, it needs must, I think, to get the best match possible, ultimately. And I liked the poetic line that Hangman Page delivered. It was very good.
The what was really bold, I think, for them to saddle their champion with that.
Intended?
Yeah, is now. And remind people that he's the... Remind people that he's the babyface that is constantly going to grapple with his confidence. I know a lot of people didn't like that in the nature of the draw with Danielson, but I think that's like one of the best features of the character, to be honest. A feature, not a bug.
Yes.
In the case of Hangman Page. But because I've got nothing else to add, I want to throw it to you because you shared some concerns, Wilborn, about Hangman Page in general, before we had a big old laugh at the what when he came in this morning about his presence as champion. And was that sort of addressed in this vignette? Or
a little bit. I talked about it on this on the news. We had a Twitter question about it on the news is why we were talking about it. Because someone's... I'll find who it was, because I always say, well, someone sent me this question, and I'm sorry, I forgot what your name is. So the question came from, on Twitter, Michael, who said he's...
I know what you just did. I just asked.
He's starting to feel like...
you wanker.
Starting to feel like he's the most third or fourth most important thing on the show. And I think that's fair enough. I think there needs to be more prominence of the world champion. But then I'm a complete hypocrite, because later on we had a world champion on this show and I was like, what's the bloody point of that promo aside from winding up the locals? So I don't know how you fix this problem, but I do feel to a certain extent... But then again, I'm a hypocrite because I think, oh yeah, the Bryan Danielson stuff, which dominated an hour and a half of, you know, TV, was absolutely sensational. I have no, I'm unwavering in my confidence as Hangman Page's world champion. I just don't, I feel like the bits where the weeks where they go, hey, we'll just put him in a silly little vignette or whatever, just really diminish him. And yes, this show was always going to be all about the lights out match and the ladder match and Punk and MJF. But I just, he's a bloody world champion. Let's talk a little bit more about him.
Let it play out.
Yes, fair.
Shut up. Let it play out. Like, he's going to do the main event at Revolution.
Mm.
They are going to sell Revolution and specifically that main event once the Archer thing's kind of done with. Harken your mind back to the Full Gear match. I thought it was phenomenal. A lot of people thought it was merely great. Regardless, it had every bit of emotional heft in the celebration and the crowning of a new top guy. Which is to state that the Kenny Omega title reign absolutely worked.
Yeah.
On that basis. There were moments throughout the Kenny Omega title reign where people said the exact same thing. It's just the way AEW books it. In the end, they've never botched a single peak of a title reign in this company yet. And I don't therefore feel it's worth critiquing what they're doing in the meantime because it's all about ebbs and flows and peaks and troughs.
Yeah, because I'll say this. I disagreed when people said when they brought back Hangman Page when he went off to, I think his missus had a baby, if I'm not mistaken. And when he came back and people were like, oh, we've all forgotten about what he was like. I was like, I haven't forgotten what he was like. I'm straight back on the tracks. So, yeah. On the horse, indeed. So, I don't know how I feel about this, but...
I do wonder sometimes on the promo thing. You know, you're saying about, oh, we'll just like toss out a quick Hangman Page promo tonight. I wonder if, because Omega was one thing, Hangman Page is maybe being a little bit damned by comparison because a Moxley promo never felt like it was we'll toss out a quick Moxley promo. It was often the highlight of the whole show. And it was the same 30, 40 seconds of him with the belt slung over his shoulder talking. But I wonder if he's damned a little bit. When Moxley wasn't working, his promo was one of the highlights of the show. And maybe he's damned ever so slightly by that comparison because he doesn't quite, in my opinion, he doesn't quite command the moment as much as Jon Moxley does and did.
Plus, maybe it's just the rot that's setting in my brain, courtesy of WWE, that I don't perceive someone as champion unless they come out with the title over their shoulder and talk for 10 minutes.
Welcome to AEW Dynamite!
That's your fault, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I've just got to relearn how to understand wrestling again. One thing I didn't like was what came next. It was a simple setting up of the tag match that's going to go down on Rampage for the AEW tag team titles, which is apparently going to be Jurassic Express, a Private Party, who inexplicably are somehow number one contenders. I know the records reset at the start of the year, but I don't think I've seen Private Party wrestle for a year, maybe, in a straight-up tag team match. It was some fun stuff. Matt's talking about the Ass Boys.
I hate that patter so much.
They're Jungle Boy slagging
off. I know who to blame, Housen, for that one.
Jungle Boy slagging off Cassidy's watch, who he says, oh, it's not fake. Matt bought me this for Christmas and what have you. But when they said, well, we were here with the number one contenders, I audibly went, well, like Hangman Page. What? what did you make of this?
Mid. So mid. And me and Cedric were discussing this a little bit before. The fact that they've referenced the Gun Club in this promo is kind of disastrous because it does force you to go and check the rankings. They're like, Private Party at the top of the rankings. And then you're like, oh yeah, and who's number two? The Gun Club. Where could this possibly go in? So it kind of renders the better of the two matches like less relevant because you know, well, you're pretty sure that's where they're going next because Billy Gunn commandeered a camera last week to set up a match that's going to happen after this one. Look, I know what they're doing with the Jurassic Express, and I think it's going to be a noble failure, which is to present them as the fighting champion babyfaces. It's not about particularly enthralling programs. It's about the longer story, which is that they took on everyone and won until they fought a team and they lost. And in that time, Jungle Boy had his own version of Darby Allin's trip with Cody Rhodes or Sammy Guevara's trip with Cody Rhodes. But, you know, like the Jungle Boy, MJF's like sort of gradual ascent through the company. This is Jungle Boy's version of that with a different belt and in a different way. So I like all that as the bigger picture. But too often, AEW's bigger picture is the best bit and the weekly ain't so hot. And that is the problem here, I think. And that's why when Private Party Matt Hardy came down the stairs, you're like, eh? Like just because you maybe know where it's going, just because one of these days, like Jungle Boy is going to get thrown all over by the House of Black, it doesn't necessarily make that vision worth some of the sludge you've got to trudge through on the way. And that, to me, like, they're using the rankings. I don't necessarily think that's such a bad thing. Like, the rankings reset, it almost, when that's done creatively, it's like, look, you can sneak in through the back door. There is something to the Gun Club getting a title shot despite only being the Gun Club, because that's almost like abuse of the rankings. But this was very much, hey, have you not been checking out Private Party? That's on you. I don't like being bollocked for not watching Dark and Dark Elevation, yeah, or however the hell they've got to where they've got to. And that's kind of what it felt like.
There's a balance that needs to be struck in terms of preserving your big matches and just goddamn doing them. I had an epiphany the other week because I wrote a really great sentence. And it was, what's the purpose?
It's the ghost that I see the most.
What's the point of having an incredible roster, the best of the century, or at least the best since the very turn of the century, if it doesn't really interact with itself enough? Gun Club. No. Oh, Red Dragon. Please.
Yeah.
FTR at number four, aren't they? And that's the first team that you get to where it actually feels all-starry in that division.
I totally get it. I'm not a moron. I wrote a book, which you can buy at amazon.co.uk or wherever you're living in the respective domain.
Smaller bookshops that pay their taxes if it's available there. No, try them.
It's not. It's not. It's on Amazon.
Go Amazon.
Don't be a socialist to the detriment of my book.
I'm a champagne one. I got it on a Kindle.
Exactly.
Didn't even flick the pages.
I understand how this thing works. You make the big matches feel premium. You keep the big acts protected. But at the same time, in doing that, you get this. And I'm bored senseless by this. It doesn't feel big. Like, we've had 2 years of this now. I've seen Young Bucks FDR once, saw Cody versus MGF once. He needs to be a little bit more gung-ho, a bit more adventurous in his booking. Does Tony Khan.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
We then got CM Punk coming out to address Cleveland and presumably address MJF. He comes out, he says, I'm here, I'm in the long boys, I'm dressed to fight, after acknowledging, you know, a fantastic reaction from Cleveland as well. He gets the crowd, for once, for the first time ever, I think he said, to chant MJF. And then he unzips his jacket and reveals MJF's Burberry scarf that he stole last week. And he says, oh, yeah, I looked into this, and I thought, oh, what a fancy scarf. And then I found out you can buy a 12-pack on Amazon for $5, which, I mean, I'll probably buy some of those if that's okay. He said, I looked into it as well, and this is made in Long Island. It's not made of strong material. But he says, look, I'm sick of talking. Let's get MJF out here. But let's be honest, we all know when he comes out, he isn't going to fight, even though I've run through every single person that I could fight in the Pinnacle. Out comes MJF. He wants his music cut off, and so does CM Punk. The big you suck chant, of course. And he does the old... Do you want to see me fight CM Punk tonight? I know I'm here in a suit, but who'd like to see me get changed and go and fight him? I can't hear you. Who wants... Ah, bollocks, I'm not doing it. he riles them up even more so. He said, are you out of your mind? I'm wasting one of the most historical matches on Cleveland. This place is disgusting. It's a cesspool. So next week, we're going to get the match we want in Chicago. It's CM Punk versus, and he paused and sort of scratched his chin at this point, and I fully bought on the suggestion that he was going to say Colt Cabana. But
did they want you to think he was going to say
the pause was because I was like, well, there's no one else left,
because he did this in the exact same promo you mentioned, a lot of like court stuff, suing.
But yeah, he did announce next week, CM Punk versus MJF. He said, look, whilst this match is no doubt going to be spectacular, unfortunately, the outcome is going to be quite upsetting because not only am I going to beat CM Punk in his hometown, MJF said, something quite unsettling is going to happen because people are going to finally see the real CM Punk, the one who loses his fake smile the second he doesn't get what he wants, the Punk who blames all of his failures on everyone else but himself, though he's more than willing to sue if he feels he hasn't got his just due. He said the same hero who claimed that he left wrestling will come back and say he's leaving wrestling again soon. He'd never leave us again, though, right? He loves us. And didn't you all say that about LeBron James? And I was like, ah, Cleveland Cavaliers. I understood that reference. he talked about Punk no-showing Cleveland in 2014 when he left WWE. And he said, when I beat you, you're just going to go and cry about it on a podcast. Cry about it on this podcast if you want. We're number one. Punk responds, you'll probably listen to it because you're a bloody mark. He says, the best thing, these two things I'm going to say are true, but they are they're mutually exclusive. The best thing I ever did was leave, and the best thing I ever did was come back. He says he's never lied, but he'd rather be him and try and fail than be MJF and just never show up. He said, look, MJF, you used to pay to stand in line and see me to get my autograph. How dare you try and put it on these people? I stand my decisions. I stand by these people. These people don't love me because I win or hate me because I lose. They love me because I get up and I try and I fight, just like Cleveland. And MJF goes, oh, really? Let's test that real quick. And out comes the Pinnacle. They're still a thing. FTR and Wardlow, and I was thinking, all right, yeah, get out of the way. Where's the real star of the show? He's sneaking into Attack Punk in the ring, jumps him. They all beat him down. They twat him with the chair. They, like, hold him out, and FTR hold him out, and they have some of that, you prick. And Wardlow's very sort of passive in all this, and his face is brilliantly expressive of just like, oh, I'm not sure about all this, lads. And MJF pokes him in the chest and says, powerbomb. And I don't know how to put the how to describe the way he did it.
I'm better than this.
Yeah.
Then I know
he went, okay, this pays my bills, I suppose. Powerbombs CM Punk, not just into the ring, but into the chair that is remaining in there. And MJF, just a brilliant conclusion to it all. Doesn't just, you know, put his foot on CM Punk's chest or stand over him or anything. He sits on CM Punk, cross-legged, and says, it's very apropos that the same place your career started is where it's going to end. I'll see you, Punk, in Chicago.
Do they goddamn book these cities? Do they think about this with such an incredible amount of detail that they book these cities to tell these incredible stories? They don't. They just tell incredible stories and they think of every possible perspective from which to tell them. What I loved most about this promo, particularly on MJF's side of things, even though, like, CM Punk doing a sort of a big rallying cry is often so susceptible to being corny and earnest and cheesy. Hey, I'm the Midwest guy, not just Chicago. He still got it over, so that was incredible. Punk's just ability to sell fury as well, man.
Mm.
Well, like, it's no wonder he tried to do film, because he's an incredible actor. But just MJF selling the very real gravity that, you know, he could actually lose here, which is phenomenal. The idea of them arriving at the idea of I was meant to be in Cleveland, what, 7 years ago? Mm-hmm. 8 years ago at this point? Let's use that. It was great because it felt like, oh, this guy's had a lowest ebb before and MJF could be the guy to plunge him right down to those depths yet again. Just incredible storytelling and an absolute gorgeous attention to detail. It was great to see the Pinnacle do a heel spot. You know what else I loved about it is that Darby Allin and Sting didn't save him.
Mm.
Might consider that a plot hole, but at the end of the day, this roster's so big and they've got a firmly established rule that everyone has an associate, because when they have an associate, it allows you to not do the big singles match. That's just a staple of AEW's booking. But because everyone's got a mate, everyone gets saved, and everyone's a bastard with their bastard pals, they do run-ins, and it's like, it's so redundant. I love this departure from it, because sometimes a babyface just has to fight his own battles. And I loved the heat. God damn it.
Heat.
The heat. CM Punk selling on that chair was like,
yeah, it would probably hurt, but it was just tremendous.
Yeah.
Absolutely tremendous. Wardlow's acting like... Ordinarily, when they do the wrestler fights associate of their principal rival, it's getting a little bit worn, it's getting a little bit cliched. Danielson did the Dark Order, Punk's doing the Pinnacle. How they're dovetailing the storyline with the Wardlow and MJF breakup has made all of this, like, transcended what has become a trope, because Wardlow, you'd like to think, is thinking, this guy beat me, I've got more respect for him to do this. He's not just like this guy I'm beating up, like, he beat me, I kind of respect him, mm-hmm. maybe more than I do the guy who's paying my bills at this point. So the hesitation worked so wonderfully. It was informed by the fact that they had this really close match that Wardlow just lost, and he felt like, yeah, I'm going to lick my wounds here, I respect this guy, I don't really want to do this to him because I've been in war with him. Just all of this is absolutely just transcendent pro wrestling storytelling.
Tits.
It's tits. It's more tits than NXT 2.0 somehow.
Yeah, I'm running out of superlatives for this entire program, which is less than ideal when I'm privileged to get paid to talk about it week on week. I've felt this with a couple of their segments where I genuinely feel intimidated about talking about it on a podcast because it is just speaking so loudly for itself. It's absolutely marvelous. The Towns thing, I was on, like, I'd allow myself to forget that this is the exact same program where CM Punk was an awesome heel for a week, and he reminded us in the reference to Long Island, and he gets to be the Cleveland guy who has all these demons in this town, and it's not going to end, but it's going to peak in Chicago, which is his town. And like, the geography side of it shouldn't be understated, how brilliantly they've plotted and paced this, because plotting and pacing has kind of been how this has worked so fantastically well. CM Punk and MJF having all-time promo battles was the gimme. Yes, there was pressure on them to actually deliver on expectations, but it was the gimme of all of this. The physical work has been exceptional. CM Punk's selling of Wardlow's, like, Wardlow here and Wardlow in the match has been fantastic. His confidence and, like, assuredness in the match with Sting and Darby Allin against FTR and against Shawn Spears was vital, because, like, he's basically shown MJF his weakest side while, when it's a fair fight, showing that he beat him handily, which is the perfect chemistry for this eventual match. It's the perfect, like, seeds of doubt that you need to cast in a guy wrestling, what, at his career best currently, in the prime of his career. All that confidence that he has been diminished by what he's actually seen from CM Punk's highs and his lows over the course of the physical end of this feud. So I want to, like, it's hard to isolate praise for a single segment as fantastic as this was without everything that has fed into it and the timing of it and the way it's all been laid out. The fact that they've folded in, which we've been, like, full of praise of for weeks, how they've, like, folded in the Wardlow stuff into what is otherwise the biggest program in AEW is what makes AEW so great. Like, at no point in their biggest angles, if you went back and looked at all of them, I bet this was the case in every single one. I bet every single top-line AEW angle has also hid another one in plain sight, and that's what makes AEW so great, and that's what, like, that's the levels to this and where they are above WWE in terms of telling stories in wrestling. Punk's performance, particularly when he gets fired up, never... total contrast to the Inner Circle match, never feels fake. Like, we've talked about this as relation to Colt Cabana, right? Every Colt Cabana reference, if it ever comes up, or every allusion to it which happened here, is agreed upon. You know, they're not out there shooting cowboy, like, this is a work. And yet CM Punk is the guy that takes you away from all that. CM Punk reacts in the way that makes you feel like he needs to swing for the guy to get this out of his system. That's so powerful. That's so evocative. It reminds you of why Money in the Bank 2011 happens as it does, why those reactions in Chicago are so real and visceral, and why he sells millions of T-shirts and ice cream bars. It's because he connects. He hits different, CM Punk. MJF's delivery. Like, there's no excuse in 2022 to still get that kind of reaction for, do you want me to fight him tonight? Like, that takes work. Like, and, like, he got that, and he deserves immense credit for that as well. I feel like there was one more thing I wanted to mention, but there was just so much I loved about it that, like, I'm not going to get it all out. Yeah, that was what it was, because I forgot to put it over in Orton. It takes idiocy or gumption to, like, directly lift a Rock t-shirt design, and Sean Spears has got both.
Yes!
Identical font, like that Just Swing It t-shirt. Like, I'm amazed, Will Bond, you haven't already placed your order, because you've got your current favourite guy aping your previous favourite guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's like CM Punk getting, like, a Hitman 316 shirt made in, like, the pink Austin 316 font all at the same time, with the fists coming out the side and on the back saying, I also like Serena Deeb. Like, I just saw, like, Bailey's also good too, in brackets. Like, I just saw that, and I was like, well, that's absolutely perfect. Only Sean Spears. Like that was the one other thing. Like he managed to sort of like draw focus. Was like, remember the pinnacle? Remember the feeling when they formed? And you were like, Jesus Christ, AEW was on notice. It wasn't, but it felt like it was, because CM Punk was. That was the other thing. MJF, yes, the cross-legged thing was obviously about CM Punk, but mimicking Kenta's Wrestle Kingdom teabagging it on the guy that first stole the go to sleep.
Yeah.
Nice that. Nice. One for Kenta. Who, by the way, we need to extend our apologies to, because when we were talking about last year's beach break, as pointed out to Twitter, we completely forgot that he smashed open the Forbidden Door and beat up John Moxley. So, like, kudos and flowers to Kenta.
Too good. Too good.
And yet, this wasn't even the best promo on the show, because that came next. The Acclaimed were not happy with John Moxley. They said, whenever we face you, you've always had to cut corners, jumping us before the bell, or jumping Max before his match, or whatever it is. Look, everyone's happy that he's back, but he's going to face Bowens on Friday, and they're going to get some revenge. Michael Hamflett, Oscar Kokoschka looking ass.
I popped absolutely huge for this.
Who's Oscar Kokoschka?
Oscar Kokoschka is a character from the glorious Nicktoon Hey Arnold. And I wanna and I wanna isolate Hey Arnold for praise, because of all the Nicktoons that they could have been
<It's> Moxley.
They could have inferred. Like the lookalike is great. But that's like the elite tier Nicktoon against all the rest. Like a kids show. That kind of talked about the like difficult class system of New York City. Quite amazing. They all went to PS118. There was like kids from all like sectors of New York's like diverse and rich society, and it's being beamed to some idiot kids in England that you can vote for on Watch Your Own Wednesday on Nickelodeon. It just Oscar Kokoschka like hit me in a way that I wasn't expecting.
Loved it.
I'll fire up at Hey Arnold when I get home, I think.
Big football head.
Yeah, I had Tony D'Angelo in it.
We get a...
Bowens and Moxley. We were talking yesterday. Who's the guy that you put in the way of Moxley and Brian Danielson? Anthony Bowens. Sublime. They've done it again. He is the exact person on that roster of many to fill that spot.
So annoyed, pin, and he's getting better every time he's in the ring.
So no, I was going to say the Acclaimed when we were talking about it yesterday. I forgot, and now it just looks like a load of bollocks.
Yeah, sounds to me like that was a work.
Griff Garrison, Julie Hart are backstage. They're talking about the House of Black. And they get interrupted, of course, because it's AEW. Mark Sterling shows up. He's making Julia Hart sign a waiver because of... I can't remember what he said, whether he said the eye stuff or whatever it is, or the eye patch stuff.
Thanks for listening.
Something along those lines, but it tickled me. He made her sign a waiver because she's facing Jade Cargill for the TBS Championship on Rampage. Griff Garrison tries to tell her not to do it. He needs time to heal, time to recover, etc. She says, no, I can fight my own battles.
Yep, set up a match. I mean, I don't care.
It's fun to like think about what Jade Cargill's going to do to her. Get her in the house. Get her in the House of Black. Like that's where this should have.
A clip of her in a House of Black promo later as well.
Remembered
this.
I don't know. I saw quite a funny bit. Somebody had put together a supercut of it was either in Being the Elite or Sammy's vlog of her selling that she can't see out of the eye. So it's like she was just walking at the doors and she went in the wrong toilets and things like that. So they were having fun with it, but I'm assuming that's not canon. As relates to the House of Black, like maybe she's supposed to be taking this really seriously.
Alexa Bliss's journey back to Raw is taking a short amount of time than Julia Hart's journey to the House of Black.
Yeah.
She's been corrupted because she's the innocent looking cheerleader. I get it, just do it.
Wasn't about being you, Julia. It's about making you go in the wrong toilet. Right, next up, it was Red Velvet versus Legit Layla Hirsch.
And God bless the United States.
still makes you laugh.
Apologies to Layla Hirsch because she's mint, but Hirsch.
Shake.
Right there.
Sounds same.
So they fight immediately before the bell. Red Velvet's desperate to get her hands on her for what Layla Hirsch has done before, of course. But Velvet hits Hirsch with a drop kick, goes for the final slice, but Hirsch rolls out, eventually starts beating Velvet down. Velvet fights back, knee lift, cut her over the ropes. She goes for that triangle hold, but Hirsch powers out of it and sort of buckle bombs her and goes after Velvet's shoulder. She takes off the tape and she targets it during the break. Velvet hits a springboard stunner to make a comeback, double knees to Hirsch's back, spears her, gets a two count, but Hirsch then counters the final slice, hits a power bomb, hits a knee strike. She's got the match won. This infuriated me, and I know this is going to be quite divisive. She's got the match won, and then, because of the shoulder stuff, she stops pinning her, transitions into an armbar, but Velvet can get her foot on the ropes for a break. Then they have to do this cradle exchange. Hirsch grabs onto Velvet's tights and steals the victory, cheating, which makes a lot of sense, since you're going to talk about Hamfler. And then post-match, she puts her back in the armbar. She won't let it go until Chris Statlander runs down to make the save.
On the match, I'm starting to think that AEW's reaping what they're sowing with their marginalisation of the women's division, because good work is, at this point, like nearly invariably just ignored by an audience that's decided, ah, it's just the women's match then. Mm.
Yeah.
It's the Dungeon of Doom waterfall every week, isn't it? Yeah. And it's like, Serena Deeb out there and she's having to like, she has to fight really in that first couple of minutes to get that reaction.
And, you know, I thought this warranted a reaction. I generally think the big picture of how the audience has been slowly, insidiously trained to receive women's wrestling in this promotion is more of a reflection on the atmospheres that receive a match like this and the work itself. Because without being a banger, there were still moments where I thought people could have oohed and aahed over some of Layla Hirsch's just beautiful transitions, just the ability to grab any kind of limb that's in the vicinity, like a laser focus, like a deadly laser focus.
Zack Sabre Jr. was in as a guest doing that. He'd be getting those reactions.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's a goddamn shame, because I thought Layla Hirsch's heel work was tremendous. It just generally felt like they were having an actual fight.
Mm.
And it didn't expose Red Velvet as someone who's often a little bit too eager to please. But it was a short, tidy storytelling match that I thought functioned effectively for me. But it was just a yet another downer when you see, or rather don't hear, the reaction to it. I'm just going to take a little walk. And I want to see if something gets picked up on camera.
It's got a bit. Okay. What's this?
Does this get picked up?
Is she opening a door and shutting it? I'm not sure if people can hear that.
I'm just opening the forbidden door there to criticise Jim Ross all over again. At the post-match, when Layla Hirsch...
And God bless the United States.
Just continues her attack.
Yeah.
Chris Statlander makes a save. Layla Hirsch retreats. Chris Statlander goes to follow her and then stares her down instead. Jim Ross, who didn't do this during the CM Punk MGF segment, he didn't say, well, I don't know if Kiki chose that. He said during the segment, that's a magical wall. Yeah, he called out the fact that they'd used the invisible wall. They did that earlier in the night, effectively, with Punk, who couldn't wait to beat up MGF. And this is just wrestling. It's just how it works sometimes, even though I'm not the biggest fan of it. Why didn't he do it then? Why did he do it here? These women are constantly battling the booking.
Yeah.
2 years worth of booking that, for the good and the bad, people take seriously over the course of time. Why did he mention magical walls? They're struggling enough. They get enough bollocks to contend with. Now you've got the authoritative voice of the promotion just burying the segment.
We argued about the finish on this, didn't we? I thought it was dumb and you quite liked it.
Still respect Jim Ross, and I hate that he had to go through what he's gone through recently. Yeah. But, you know, Jesus
still
Christ.
Still criticised.
Oh, yeah. You can, you know, analyse his work, I think. After the Daddy Boys exploded in the opener, we're doing the big handshake and we're back together on this one. Because I agree 100% with what Cedric said. A match that was way better than what the crowd were giving it. I said I liked the finish this morning, Wilbon, and you knocked me clean out. We had such a disagreement over it. I get
what you said.
I thought it was really cool. So the whole point I made yesterday was that, like, as a babyface, Layla Hirsch would always try and polish her opponent off with something pretty cool. She likes that double jump moonsault in particular, and it always failed, and she always fell a little bit short. So she instead went about with the other. She didn't leave her feet. She went to destroy her with a ground game, and then went to do the cruel thing again, like borrowing from someone like a Serena Deeb. Like, how can I inflict more punishment than just finish somebody off? But Red Velvet has got more than just those jobbers that Serena Deeb destroys, so she's made the ropes. Hirsch, then, that would be the point, typically, when she would go to the top rope and it would go wrong. What does she do? Rolls her up, pulls the tights, cheats. It's a different Layla Hirsch, and I think that was inserted in there because typically everything we've seen from Layla Hirsch is, right, time to do the flashy shit, and she's changed. Her mentality has completely changed, and I thought that was really nice. You... like knocked me out and called me a fool and kicked me while I was down. It was good. Like I admired your passion for how much you didn't like this finish.
Yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of Layla Hirsch.
And God bless the United States.
And not just because. But I get that, and I completely understand the grabbing. I did no issue with the grabbing of the tights for the finish.
Mm.
Don't have the bit before it. That is what I'd say. No, I don't keep the armbar if you want.
Mm.
but don't have her hit a knee strike where she's got her pinned, she's beaten her, or at the bare minimum, make Red Velvet kick out. What annoyed me is she went, knee strike, bloody hell, that's knocked her out. One, two, actually, bollocks, I'm going to transition to the armbar. I just thought it was a really bad bit of booking because you
no,
got...
dear, that's wrong.
I just thought it was just it really dumb because if she's this, you know, great ground game and stuff, she's really close to the ropes there.
Mm.
Like, and if she's out cold, she doesn't know to put a foot on the ropes. If you give her time and then put the armbar on, she goes, oh, bloody hell, armbar, I'm very close to the ropes here. I just thought it made her look really stupid and it... overcomplicated a finish that I would have liked.
That's fair enough. I do get where you're coming from. I actually thought there was an element where, and you said the opposite there, so that's interesting. I thought a lot of that was to protect Red Velvet because she's a level above the type of, like, Layla Hirsch was always going to win this.
Yeah.
But this wasn't wrestler versus designated jobber. This was more than that. And I thought that was part of that. Like, Red Velvet's got way more guile about her.
Mm.
And I thought they were trying to suggest that, and like, I don't want to use the word protect because WWE ruined everything, but that was like, I thought there was an element of that in that finish. I dare say if the division was over and the wrestlers were over, that might have come across from the noise in the crowd as well. Like, sometimes you need the people in the seats to react to what they're being shown.
Then we got a video promo from the House of Black. He talked about Brody King, the embodiment of conflict and violence, and Brody King steps out of the darkness and says that Pac's going to be humbled. Death Triangle going to feel true pain. He says, just like death, we are inevitable. Dreaded. Run from... Oh, no, that was... Sorry, I'm... yeah, find this.
Yeah, just a slightly spooky... Well, poetic way of saying when it's going to kill people.
Mm. Mm. This is the bit where I thought I saw Julia Hart, but maybe, I don't know, maybe I just misremembered it. Like a flash of someone in an eye patch. I can't remember. I might have to go back and watch it and see if...
There is a line... There is a line that Malachi Black can't see. Maybe he's got some toxic juice in his eyes. But there's a line that he can't see, so sometimes he steps over it, sometimes he's well before it, and sometimes he walks right up to it. I think this was walking right up to it. So this absolutely preserves that these are basically just two hard lads.
Two hard lads who like metal and horror.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like this.
Yeah.
I like this. Since Brody King turned up, I'm like...
Brody King. Hang
on. I'll tell you what I've thought. House of Black.
Hey, 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 hey. You all right.
Brody King, like, walked out of the shadows. He didn't magic out of a genie's lamp or something. That's the difference that I think Malachi Black sometimes doesn't think remotely about. And that's why some segments work and some don't. This one worked.
I just have to rewatch it just in case there was a clip of Julia Hart, who, of course, has got something in her.
Aye.
Britt Baker came out next.
What's she got in her eye?
These nuts.
Not mine. Just, you know, someone's.
We said this before. Every year, there's some British podcast award that we should have won six times over by now. But you can nominate any podcast you want. And part of this, it's a bit of a...
Why not this?
Everybody should nominate this every time it comes up. It's a bit of a rigged racket, the old podcast game, because people submit their own podcast stuff to get voted. It's not just this like magic like public vote. It's not a full democracy. I can think now of two isolated clips that I would submit to the panel, and both of them involve that goddamn D's nuts button. Like, is it or is it not a good reflection of what we put out 5 days a week? I don't even know anymore.
If we don't win an award this year, you've got to say the British Podcast Awards will definitely have some
egg
on their face. Right, let's get back to Dynamite because we had a Britt Baker promo. She got all the PWI awards there. Tony Schiavone introduced her. She comes down, full Pittsburgh get up. I'll say this right now. Often this sort of stuff isn't for me, and this really wasn't for me because it was just Britt Baker winding up the people of Cleveland with lots of local sports-based references, which I got it. I'm a vague sort of American football fan, go Colts, but it's like Cleveland Browns, Pittsburgh Steelers, we beat you, your quarterback's crap or whatever it was, and that's all I felt that it was here. Maybe it's just, again, my WWE brain where I was like, cool, when's the interruption coming? When's someone coming out to have a fight with her and set up her next feud or whatever? Look, she made great points. She talked about the insane year she had. She talked about making it a Brit-topia, I think it was. She created this women's division. She's the face of AEW. You know, she's main evented shows, etc. She said she basically wasn't going to stop until she's the female of the decade. I very much was just like, cool, so that happened.
I'm going to feel like such an absolute hypocritical prick here. But it was just like, sometimes I've said, in fact, several times I've said, this program is episodic to a fault. This is not remotely episodic. And I was like, get to the point. What this was she wants some awards. They want to market this. Good. She loved this baker line, and it was very, very good. But it wasn't quite good enough to write like a 5-minute promo around.
Yeah,
like, it was a really good line. I thought, that's why I've done this. Like, it was, didn't really serve a purpose. Which, again, sometimes a heel can just come out and say, "I'm the goddamn best," and they can just exist as something that happens. But this wasn't a very good vehicle with which to say I'm the best. It was just a bit long.
Yeah, I thought Nyla Rose's promo was much better, and it took 20 seconds.
Yeah,
an actual thing that felt like an interruption.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I'm a hypocrite as well, because I kind of praised CM Punk for half of this, and I was begging for an interruption. So it's just like exposing how wrestling can be this way sometimes. There are some things that suit situations more than others. This was all, oddly enough, I think this is going to represent a real key chapter point in, if not Thunder Rosa, Britt Baker's Revolution match. It probably should be with Thunder Rosa, but it just felt like somebody gets so arrogant and confident that they have stopped respecting the competition, and it brings about their downfall.
Mm.
And this was like a great, like, especially like decorated with loads of awards, completely irrelevant local sports stuff, just to lord it over people for the sake of it, almost as if to say, I have got nothing left to do. I think, Sidgwick, you mentioned it yesterday, the idea of beating Chris Statlander, if they'd have gone with that, would have been, well, I've lapped everyone. Yeah. This was a way to do that without, like, directly acknowledging somebody, which, again, Thunder Rosa, that's quite smart, because she doesn't want to. Like, that's actually a spectre in Britt Baker's record. It's not something that she...
Just in the subtext, he was genius.
Well, maybe. It just felt entirely essential watching this. This is what I mean. Like, if you imagine that Thunder Rosa and Britt Baker is booked for Revolution, and then they have a video package, this is at the start of it. It's Britt Baker. Yeah. So I've cleared out the division. Here's my awards. Like, I'm still not getting enough flowers, and I'm getting loads of flowers, and I want even more. And then she won't acknowledge that the one person that beat her at the beginning of all this could have had a number the entire time. One little side note to this, like, I don't mean to be alarmist for people that loved this act and loved something that they were clearly doing. Where's Rebel and Jamie Hayter?
Yeah.
Because there's been a few weeks of this now, and I appreciate the Adam Cole thing was for that purpose, but they could have been with her then too.
It's weird as well. I just wouldn't have done this at all, even though that Baker line was really, really good. One, I wouldn't have put the most improved trophy out there. However, that just didn't look good. She had plenty of others to brag about. I wouldn't have had Britt Baker in incredible peacocking confidence mode look perfectly healthy ahead of a match that was made because her boyfriend was so upset by how bad she got last week.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even think about it. That's a really good point.
Oh, I'm full of them.
Well, like I said, this was followed after they ran through they were running through what's coming up on the next few shows. Nyla Rose comes out and just fumes on the mic. Vicky Guerrero does the whole excuse me thing. And she says, look, I'd be TBS champion if it wasn't for Ruby Soho and a fluke victory. Next week, I want her in a match. Good, simple stuff. Gets the job done.
I always assume that the Goldberg run itself that I expect Jade Cargill to have was going to be what babyfaced her. I think it's going to be a Goldberg run and beating Nyla Rose. It's going to babyface her because Nyla Rose seems nailed on to be the challenger you actually might think might dethrone Jade Cargill. When she doesn't get it done, there's going to be no choice but to be like, Jesus Christ, not only has Jade Cargill come on, she's also like, I want to love this character.
They're doing a Soho versus Rose in Chicago because Soho's from Chicago.
Isn't she? She is. She got that massive response that... she's loved there. I know that she got that.
Yeah, she's loved there, even if she's not from there.
So Soho gets to beat Nyla Rose. Well, just forget everything I said then. Back to the old rotation for Nyla Rose, who's awesome whenever she gets 5 seconds of television.
Right, looks like it's time for it.
Well, looks like we've had enough.
Lights.
It's time for the main event.
Because it's an unsanctioned lights out match.
You got bad news.
Well,
looks like we've had enough talk.
This is from Michigan.
Ah, they just...
She was...
Maybe it's going to be all right.
They just popped huge for her.
I mean, I'd rather have Nyla Rose win at this point.
Yeah, me too.
So it was the unsanctioned.
She just has granted as a theme tune. No, she's good, but she's not from Chicago.
No, that's a big Chicago thing, isn't it?
Unsanctioned lights out match. Adam Cole versus Orange Cassidy. Tell Orange Cassidy's taking this seriously. Comes out and he crushes his sunglasses. I like Tony Schiavone. We've never seen him do that with his sunglasses to start the match. Big brawl to start us off. They trade right hands. They go out to the floor. Orange Cassidy sends Cole into the barricade and hits that hands in pockets, shotgun drop kick. Cole fights back, though, then goes under the ring to get a chair and pulls out. And guess who's attached to it but the one and only Danhausen, who is now apparently All Elite. Let's just pause that there. What do you reckon to Danhausen being All Elite before we continue with this match?
I don't really care either way about Danhausen. Like, I don't understand the fascination with the Danhausen character. It's not my thing. I don't resent it for being your thing. It's all a bit twee. I know it's not twee because he's like a tooth-collecting demon adjacent, impish guy with a sense of humour, but I just feel like it's a bit cute, and it's just not for me. People can have it if they want. It's a strategic good move. He's going to sell loads of merchandise. He's going to be a bit part character who does the odd thing that will pop you at times. I'm not bothered.
I will say this, he did get a snap crackle and huge bap.
Yeah. In all caps as well. Gotta remember this one. Gotta remember this.
Can't blow my cereal joke. Yeah, I'm with Sidgwick. And why would I not be? We're the same age, same wrestling fan profile. Like, I'm confused at how he got over. I saw.
He was grafted for this, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he really worked for
him. Almost like felt made Tony Khan feel guilty for not signing him. Yeah. Look, I'm pretty much part of the roster.
I don't
know. Jesus, to get the checkbook out and on.
I'm not only a wrestler, it's a meet and greet. Like, I saw this kind of thing go down well with teenagers, like when me and Sidgwick were 17, 18, you know? I don't know how it's gotten over now. The kids are way cooler than we were. Like, they're way more into things that I will never possibly be able to
like
understand.
TikTok?
I don't know how. I don't know how it's worked, but it has, right, with Danhausen. I have.
Mineral, and they like TikTok, so don't tell me that they're
almost zero knowledge of if you can go, but I'm reliably I'm reliably informed that, and I'm not going to name names, but if you look on Twitter or you speak to the right people, that you can't. So
I put a Discord records top. Don't tell me that these TikTok kits are cooler than
where the kids just use Discord now. I don't know. It was the right signing. The second he got that response, the second he got his name chanted, because AEW have to, at very least, have the finger on the pulse. Like, that's like kind of a minimum expectation of All Elite Wrestling, if only to be the rival to WWE. So that response immediately justified the signing. Well, no, it justified the appearance. Will it justify the signing?
Yeah.
We have to wait. If anything, and I think Orange Cassidy is evidence of this, those characters have to be like used with a certain delicacy on like weekly television wrestling. And will Very Nice, Very Evil be funny in 6 weeks? More importantly, will the thirst for him to get this platform he deserves be as strong? Is anybody now that bothered? And this is not a dig at this wrestler. Is anybody tweeting either of you two about Fuego del Sol?
Fair.
Because they're not me, right? And that was all we got for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And I love that the graft can get people this opportunity. This goes all the way back to frigging Warhorse getting a TV match in a pandemic. Really cool that this is what AEW is. I'm not saying Danhausen's or what, there might be more to this. I don't know. Like, this is the opposite of, what was it on like SmackDown? I was like, you know, tell me what I'm missing about SmackDown that still gets it praise. I don't want you to tell me what I'm missing about Danhausen, because I'm told it all the time, and I don't think it's going to cut through, but it cuts through with enough people. He's going to sell a load of t-shirts, or he's going to do whatever
Fair's fair. Like, I said the same thing when Cardona originally got signed. Like, I've got no interest in watching him again. I think pro wrestling's passed by the guy who got over in 2011, but Jesus Christ, he got over once and he was completely botched. Give him a chance.
Mm.
Danhausen's grafted. Give him a chance. No, I don't really care.
Chris Jericho's found his next feud, that's for sure. Right, anyway. So
also, sorry, actually, before we move on to the match, although this to sort of come in at the end of it as well, I'm mixed on, like, spoiler, I didn't really like this match, but I'm mixed on the use of Danhausen here. I think they were intending to make this lights out thing feel different because they were worried about how it would be compared to the lights out matches. I think that
this was like a tell for me.
It was an ineffective way to tap me on the shoulder and make it look the way. Say, different lights out. It's not going to be as violent as the one. Measure your expectations. I don't think it worked in that regard. I think all it did was make people pop at Danhausen.
Well, it not only threw us off on this podcast, but it threw off the competitors because Orange Cassidy suddenly came out of nowhere with a DDT, having been as confused as Adam Cole, basically, with the whole Danhausen thing as he poses and then walks up the ramp. Cole recovered, though, pump kick through a chair. He goes to the Panama Sunrise, but Orange counters it and puts him through the table with a spine buster, tries to follow it up with the Orange Punch, but Cole's grabbed the ring bell and smashes Orange Cassidy's hand with it, which would factor
great into spot, I would just like to say.
Lovely touch, that. Targets his hand throughout the commercial, although Orange shoots some fire extinguisher at him to get a bit of space in amongst all that. They've got the chain in the ring. They're sort of both pulling at it, trying to grab it and use it. Cole hit the Ushigoroshi, gets a two count, he sets some chairs up, tries to put Orange through the chairs, but Orange counters it with a Stundog Millionaire and a Michinoku driver through the chairs for a two count. And they focus in on the blood that's now seeping from Orange Cassidy's hand, who runs into a super kick, and Cole waves to the back. And you think, wow, which one of the super kick are we getting? Oh, it's Brandon Cutler. Out he comes.
which is funny.
It was quite, it was a lovely touch, that, in terms of like, come on, guys, come on. He's out there with the spray. I'm here, Adam, I'm here. Except he obviously gets taken out by Wheeler Yuta, then Bobby Fish takes out Yuta, then Chuck Taylor takes out Bobby Fish, and then the Young Bucks come down after Bobby Fish has been chucked into the barricade by Chuck Taylor, hit him with a double super kick. They go to hit a triple super kick alongside Cole on Orange Cassidy, but Roppongi Vice come out and stop them, and Orange hits the beach break and the Orange Punch on Adam Cole, but the Orange Punch with the damaged hands means that he can't make the cover. As Orange Cassidy standing there recovering, Cole low blows him, and Orange Cassidy completely no-sells it to reveal he's wearing a cup covered in thumbtacks. Cole is writhing around off the back of this. Orange Cassidy, this is the moment where I started going, oh, yep, you've got me wanting Orange Cassidy to win. Orange Cassidy hits a Panama Sunrise to get a near fall. He wraps the chain around his hand, and Cole bails out there, goes to the backstage area. The lead singer Nickelback's there. Jerry Lynn's there. And he's sort of used as a distraction to allow Cole to, a bit of interference.
We're quite close to Tony Khan as well. 9 feet.
Cole puts Orange through the go position table where the two men have been sitting. They go back out onto the stage. Cole hits a super kick, goes to lower the boom, but Orange Cassidy super kicks him himself, goes to the chain-assisted Orange Punch, but Cole grabs one of those huge lights that they use on the stage and hits him with it, and Cole decides it's not enough to just finish him off here, to lower the boom on the stage. He's going to climb up on top of the staging, and he does so, but in the time it's taken him to get up on behind the sort of video boards and what have you, Orange Cassidy's nowhere to be seen. Cole's asking the ref where he's gone. Orange Cassidy appears behind him, low blows Adam Cole, and this is the bit where I went, go on then, hugs him, look over the side, where Cole's like, first of all, don't hug me, and second of all, no, what are you doing? He jumps, takes Cole with him, off the stage, through the stage, covers him. 1, 2, 3. Orange Cassidy wins lights out, Michael Sidgwick.
Your reading was better than the match, I think.
Really good reading.
Because I really liked the spot from which Cole took control. The bell to the punch. Very unusual. That was really good. I was just totally blindsided by the tone. And it's, I don't think it's my, when you say, oh, the match should have been the way I booked it, because I wanted the full Muta, Dustin Rhodes, Vince McMahon, Survivor Series 2003, like with that jam on his face, bleeding so much, because, oh, it's Orange Cassidy, the guy giving the most he's ever cared in this match. So I was blindsided by the fun and breezy quasi-comedy tone. They try to balance the tone of it, because it's a goddamn lights-out match, and they set a precedent of this is the most violent stip that you're going to see
in modern North American wrestling, like the most violent wrestling of the century, basically. Because even by 2000, WWE stips were a little bit like, just blindsided by the tone. Danhausen, I think, was very much, if we're going to debut him here, let's debut him in a match that will allow people to realize, oh, hang on, we're not going to see a double juice. But I still kind of thought, the tone of it was not bad in itself, given the story of the feud and whatnot and the players involved, but it was hard to get involved. So I was kind of like, oh, where's the gore? I want to see some gore. There were elements of the match I liked. Look, this was the babyface prevailing over the heel. It's a wrestling tale as old as time. The way they arrived at that with the intended nut shot and the retribution for all of the other nut shots, all very nicely done. I enjoyed the absurdity of the hug being a finisher at the same time, even though I think they might have thought it was funnier than it actually was because it took ages registering the punchline. I thought, it's a bit awkward, this. Just bump him. just beat him. But there was just a certain energy lacking throughout that is disjointed, unfair.
No, I expectations, I think you're right, yeah.
It wasn't just the expect, like, it was just, well, I got whiplash out of the place. I was right, I'm not going to get blood. I will attempt to disregard everything they told us about these matches and get into what this actually is. And even then, I just thought, I would have thought they would have relished the opportunity of really putting this together, and it was good, just not great.
It's funny you mentioned Nickelback, because I thought this was too bland. It wasn't so much expectations of violence, it was expectations of creativity that weren't met for me. The cup and the finish aside, I think there was anywhere near enough exploration of what these characters could do to each other with the circumstances laid out, you know? But then I don't think the story's been particularly that textured either. I think all of this has been a bit too lazy for my liking. Adam Cole and Orange Cassidy is the exact sort of thing that you'd be pinching yourself talking about in 2019. You know, when they're both on different shows and Orange Cassidy's just peaking as this incredible television, like star in the making. And we get here and it's way too much of a plunderbolt. I was never even a massive fan of Moxley and Omega in Lights Out. And I like that far much more through watching this because I thought this was that much of I found that to be like very impressive. Plunder Brawl, but a Plunder Brawl nonetheless. And I don't hold Plunder Brawls in hugely high regard. This was a pretty boring Plunder Brawl. And it hasn't honestly made me respect the, like, not the original, but the AEW original far more than this. They weren't particularly violent. They weren't hugely creative, save for certain spots. They were, the Danhausen thing registered exactly the same to me. I've got to receive this differently now. I have to look at this differently as a result. Maybe not everybody will take it that way, but that's certainly how I did. It didn't. Maybe it was the natural payoff to this feud because this feud hasn't scaled the heights that it might have done on paper. The point about how long they lingered on the hug maybe sums it all up because maybe they always thought all of the mixed tag was the same. You always thought all of this was going to be slightly more spectacular than it was right through at the end. And yesterday I predicted Orange Cassidy would win and both of you said, like, it can't be. Did you feel afterwards that it could be?
Yes. This is the point where I was going to say, I went in, not with the Lights Out stipulation so much at the front of my mind, but with the arms folded, you can't beat your number one contender for a world championship match.
We fantasy put this in our heads.
Yeah.
So that should not go unmentioned. Mm. But even if that isn't the direction, like Adam Cole coming from NXT, should be losing this early. He's been in there a while, I guess.
And again,
he is fighting for the title.
And he's not on the records and blah, blah, blah.
But we don't know that.
No, they haven't told us outright yet. Well, they sort of did in the commentary and him saying he was number one New Year. I'm gonna have the biggest year ever. He was as good as setting up the Page match. And then
I fantasy booked it 4 months ago, so I'm doubting myself.
I think I went in going, their job in this match is not to match all the Lights Out contests. It's to make me want Orange Cassidy to win because he's the babyface. I love Adam Cole.
Deserved this, and the characters deserve this.
The plunder, I talked about Deaden in the ladder match. This isn't the first time we've had this conversation / complaint about AEW. The reliance on plunder's a bit of a problem. I should be more excited about a Texas Deathmatch World Heavyweight title, but we've just had a Lights Out match on the same show as a ladder match, and we're never more than like a fortnight away from something equally violent. It's like, this is not me doing a sort of think of the children like thing. It's more of a think of how boring it's getting.
Maybe, you know, I just thought maybe what it was, why I enjoyed this more. Do you ever have that thing where someone, like, I don't know, fancies a girl or something and gets rejected by her and then seems to start dating people who look a bit like her sort of thing? Maybe my anger at the lack of cup stuff with Styles Nakamura all those years ago has made me go, any cup stuff's brilliant. Cardona, this, one final beat. Oh, it's got cup stuff. It's fantastic. So maybe that's what it is.
Dinner with the Garganos.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, let us know your thoughts. I've been fascinated to know what you guys think about this match, the opener of the whole show, in fact. Let us know on Twitter, at WhatCultureWWE. Watch, they can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamflett at...
Michael Hamflett.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at...
Sidgwick.
As you can still get his book, as he said as well, at Amazon if you want to go and grab that. It's fantastic.
Becoming All Elite, The Rise of AEW.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE and make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling wherever you get your podcasts from for daily wrestling podcasts. We'll be back later on today to an extended preview of the Royal Rumble. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynamite Review. My thanks to the Dudley Boys. Thank you for joining us and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.